Hello there. Today's Thursday, August 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. retailers say they are gearing up to pass on higher prices to consumers as trade tariffs start to pinch. President Trump takes a swipe at Puerto Rico as the U.S. territory and the U.S. mainland prepare for a major storm.
With time becoming a major hurricane by Saturday is what we're expecting, and then continue to be a major hurricane.
Also ahead, remembering Senator John McCain 1 year after his death. It's all on today's International Edition. The Trump administration Wednesday made official its extra 5% tariff on $300 billion worth of Chinese imports and set collection dates, prompting hundreds of U.S. retail, footwear, toy, and technology companies to warn of price hikes. While Trump in recent days has reversed his aggressive China trade rhetoric, that has not translated to a retreat from the planned tariff hikes. It remains unclear whether U.S. and Chinese negotiators will resume in-person talks in September, as previously suggested. Joining us now to talk more about the impacts starting to be felt in the U.S. and around the world is Peter Drysdale, head of the Asia Bureau of Economic Research at the Australian National University. Starting to look like it's biting here in the United States. The farmers are angry. There is talk of a recession here, possibly even a global recession. It looks almost like a power struggle now between the U.S. and China, with no one considering the impacts to the rest of the world. Is that what you're seeing?
To the reality that this is a big thing, not just between the United States and China. It impacts dramatically on the rest of the world because the two biggest traders in the world and the two biggest economies in the world having a trade war that's intensifying in this way impacts upon the whole global trading system.
Now, if the president would want some sort of a win, as he would put it, like a quick deal before the election, to make it look as if he actually succeeded in this effort. Even if there was a deal at this point or at some point in the coming months, would it put everything back together, or would both countries and possibly others still take a hit?
Oh, well, that's most unlikely that a deal that's done anytime soon is going to put everything back together again, given the structure of this tussle. Laurie, what a deal would do maybe is settle the dust momentarily between the United States and China, but that inevitably involves arrangements that affect the rest of the world. It involves special purchasing of U.S. goods by China, and special arrangements which constitute a form of managed trade between the two countries. And inevitably that impacts on other countries. Australia will be affected, Latin America will be affected, Europe will be affected. And so the rest of the world would be worried.
If this doesn't get resolved and the President Trump does not get reelected and the next president that comes in stops this, would that fix everything, or would it be something that would require a lot of time and energy to turn around?
Well, I think a change in policy strategy, however implemented by President Trump himself or by a new president after the 2020 election, that's a long time to wait. I think if we had to wait that long for a change in strategy, then I think we can be confident that there's going to be a global recession.
All right, that is Peter Drysdale, head of the Asia Bureau of Economic Research at the Australian National University. Thank you for being with us. More than 300,000 people currently have temporary protected status, or TPS, in the United States. The status allows non-citizens to live and work here in the U.S. when their home countries are deemed unsafe. But the Trump administration now is trying to cancel the program, and that decision has many families worried. VOA's Christina Smith reports.
The life of the Ayala family was turned upside down and into a state of panic in 2018 by one proclamation by then Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. Nielsen called for an end to the program called Temporary Protective Status, or TPS. It largely benefits migrants from El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Sudan, who are fleeing countries in the middle of ongoing armed conflict, an environmental disaster, or any other extraordinary circumstance.
La verdad, no.
The truth is that our children never knew much about our status until 3.5 years ago to 4 years. My oldest daughter, who also has TPS, started her college application process, and back then, she began to understand a little more about what her status is.
The Ayala family arrived in the United States in 2001. The same year, El Salvador was struck by an earthquake. After being granted TPS, the Ayalas found a home, jobs, and eventually had 2 children.
We've been living in the United States for more than 20 years. We feel like this is our home. Our kids feel this is home.
But should TPS end for good, it could mean the Ayalas would be kicked out of the country. TPS is currently being challenged in court and the Ayalas are named in legal briefs. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments earlier this month.
It is very possible that this case might end up in the Supreme Court. With the appointment of the latest judge, the Supreme Court has become more conservative. So it is possible that our challenge will fail, but we are determined to fight all the way.
DOA reached out to Homeland Security Department officials for comment. They declined to comment on the court case, saying they don't comment on active litigation. But they did say current law requires an ongoing review if countries and their citizens still qualify for TPS, and end the status should circumstances in those countries change. Cristina Quecedo-Smith, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump and San Juan's mayor are going at it again as another major storm targets Puerto Rico, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president's apparently still smarting over some Puerto Rican officials criticizing his administration's response to Hurricane Maria 2 years ago. San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz was among the most outspoken, the president's calling her incompetent and Puerto Rico one of the most corrupt places on earth. He's again making a claim fact-checkers have repeatedly knocked down, that Puerto Rico's received more aid than any place ever. The mayor is telling the president to get out of the way and make way for those of us who are actually doing the work on the ground. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Meanwhile, the threat to the U.S. mainland is growing. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says Dorian is expected to become dangerous as it enters warm Atlantic waters near the U.S. southeast. Here's National Hurricane Center Director Ken Graham.
Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the British Virgin Islands, even though we're past the islands, remember, some of these rain bands stretching around here can still produce a lot of rainfall overnight. So we'll still have to be careful, still rain falling in a lot of these areas. So you need to pay attention to that just in case you start getting some flash flooding.
Hurricane Dorian is expected to strengthen even further in the coming days as it approaches the east coast of Florida. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. military says it is too soon to discuss Afghanistan troop withdrawal. China threatens retaliation if the U.S. sells F-16 fighter jets to Taiwan. President Trump attacks Puerto Rico even as a major storm approaches. And Brazil's president does accept Chile's help in battling the Amazon wildfires. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, this week marks 1 year since the passing of Senator John McCain. He died 1 year ago on August 25th, and today is his birthday. In the spirit of McCain's unwavering efforts to promote civility in our political discourse, the McCain family and the McCain Institute is celebrating his life by encouraging acts of civility. Cindy McCain released a video on the occasion.
In the coming weeks, our family will celebrate the life of my husband, John McCain.
It's been a year since John passed away. Like many of you, I miss his voice of reason and commitment to civility that has been sadly absent from our national dialogue. John taught us by example to commit to causes larger than ourselves and to join together across the aisle or whatever divides us to make our world a better place. So I know John will want to mark this anniversary by doing something that adds to the common good. As a family, when we mark his passing and his birthday, we are going to perform some acts of civility. Please take some time that week to re-engage with someone whom you disagree, or commit to work together with someone who has had a different perspective than you, and find common ground. Then post your social media channels about your act of civility using hashtag acts of civility. By taking this simple step, we join together and can help inspire a renewal of civil engagement that is critical for us to meet the challenges of the future. Thank you for honoring John in this way.
Well, this is obviously a very important week for the McCain family and the McCain Institute and the many friends and Americans who loved him. Joining us to hear more about how the family and the McCain Institute is honoring the late senator is Kurt Volker. He's the executive director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership and former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, and you're exactly right. This is an important week to remember the contributions that he made, his legacy, and to try to carry that forward as much as we can. What we have opted to do this year is to mark a week that we are labeling Acts of Civility, hashtag Acts of Civility, because we want to encourage people to adopt the tone of civility and to recognize that we're always going to have disagreements with people. There are always issues to debate. There are always issues to fight over. But at the same time, we're all Americans. We are all trying to make our country better and stronger, and we need to be able to work together to achieve that and treat each other with respect, treat each other in a civil way, even in those areas where we have disagreement. Senator McCain did that. He was a fighter on the issues that he cared about. He was very direct, very blunt, but he also had very good friendships across the aisle, and he was respectful to all of his adversaries.
Right. It seems like it's not an accident that this is the topic and the general tone that you are looking to present this week, thinking about John McCain.
Well, that's right. I think it's characteristic of Senator McCain himself and his life and legacy. And it's also a reflection of the fact that in our society today, differences do seem sharper and arguments do seem sharper. There are more critical statements, less respect, less civility across from both sides of the aisle. And I think it's important that we remind people that at bottom we're all Americans, and at bottom we all care about making the country better.
We really haven't seen anyone take over the mantle for him in that leadership role when it comes to civility. Everyone remembers how he responded to the woman at the town hall when he was campaigning against Barack Obama. He said he didn't agree with Obama's policies, but wouldn't let the woman go on with misleading statements about former President Barack Obama being an Arab, which was stated in such that she seemed like it was a derogatory comment. And there are probably many examples of the senator's role in speaking up like that.
First off, I do want to say, I think that there are senators and others on both sides of the aisle who do demonstrate respect and civility and courtesy in dealing with each other. We see that a lot. We did an event in Los Angeles earlier this year with a Democratic senator and a Republican senator that really did provide an opportunity for a substantive conversation about issues that was not a lot of name-calling and finger-pointing. It was really a breath of fresh air. So there are people like that. The difference is that Senator McCain had such stature and national visibility that when he would take a stand on something, it was noticed. And so him doing that in the course of that election campaign and standing up for his adversary, candidate Obama at the time, as being a family man, a decent person, but with whom he had very fundamental disagreements, that was something that got a lot of notice because of who Senator McCain was.
Isn't there a difference between acting civilly and the leadership that he showed in speaking out when things weren't being done the way he felt were respectful?
I think it's kind of the same thing. You know, I think it's the way you conduct yourself. But then the thing that challenges any leader is when things are difficult, when you're confronted with adversity, do you rise to the challenge then and be true to your character? Do you live by your values? Do you serve a cause greater than yourself, as Senator McCain always tried to do, even when it's difficult? And I think that's really what marked Senator McCain as a great leader.
Was he concerned about these issues in the weeks and months leading up to his death?
I'm concerned. I think he was frustrated or troubled by the tone and the trend that you see. But Senator McCain was always someone who believed in getting into the fight in order to argue for what he believed in. And he did believe in civility and decency and respect for each other within our country. And I think he would have gotten into the middle of it if he had been with us now to argue for that himself, just as we're trying to do as an institute now.
What do you think he would think and say, witnessing some of the things that are being said in the current political climate?
Well, I think one of them is that you ought to focus on the substantive areas that we want to address and talk about. There are so many labels thrown around these days, whether, you know, whether it's racism or whether it's socialism or whether it's Nazism or fascism, all these labels that are thrown around to attack people that are not really based in arguing the substance of a position. They're really based in trying to tear down your opponent. And I think he would take a stand against that and say that's not the right way for us to be treating each other as Americans or trying to make decisions about what's best for the country.
The Acts of Civility Initiative, are there specific examples of how the Institute is working to promote this?
We wanted to do something that was commemorative and forward-looking about the senator's contributions and who he was as a person. So we created this hashtag, Acts of Civility, and made it something of a social media campaign. We've encouraged people to engage in their own acts of civility and then tweet about that or talk about that on social media. And we've gotten a very nice response.
Any overall message the McCain family and the Institute hope to convey, if you could sum it all up?
It is, again, that we're all Americans. We all believe in our country. We all want to make it better. We may have our differences, but we have to treat each other with respect and work together to make it better.
All right. That is Kurt Volker, Executive Director of the McCain Institute and former U.S. Ambassador to NATO. Thank you so much for being with us. Chinese investment in Nigeria's oil and gas industry has reached $16 billion, according to Nigeria's state-run oil company. While Nigeria's oil industry welcomes China's interest, analysts worry about a lack of transparency in the sector and slow development of the country's renewable energy market. Chika Odua reports for VOA from Enugu.
When a top official from China's third largest national oil company paid a visit to Abuja, Nigeria this month, he was recommended by a top official of Nigeria's state-run oil company to increase investment in Nigeria's petroleum industry. Mele Kyari, the group managing director of the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, or NNPC, thanked the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, or CNOOC, for its continued support of Nigeria's oil and gas sector. Chinese investments in the sector have reached $16 billion. Kyari added that Nigeria needs partners like China. The two countries need each other to reach their oil production targets. Africa's largest oil-producing nation pumps 2 million barrels a day and has a goal of producing 3 million barrels a day by 2023. China's domestic oil production has been on a steady decline due to natural depletion and other geological challenges. So experts predict that up to 80% of China's crude oil supply will be imported by 2030. In comes Nigeria. CNOOC started business in Nigeria in 2005 and is currently the largest Chinese entity investor in Nigeria. With a focus on overseas investment, it's also China's largest offshore oil and natural gas developer. The company's executive vice president, Liu Yanji, said during the meeting that Nigeria is one of the company's largest investment destinations. He also said that CNOOC is producing 800,000 barrels per day, but it wants to reach 1.2 million. Ji hopes Nigeria can help with that, but there's skepticism. Nigeria has had a hard time reaching its production targets. There's sporadic militancy in the oil-producing region, as young people often take violent action to demand more access to the country's oil wealth. There's theft happening right at the pipelines. Fires often burn at rusted pipes and oil operations in Nigeria get disrupted several times a year. Also, there's a serious lack of transparency. The NNPC has a long history of scandals with ongoing accusations of corruption. Crude oil is Nigeria's most lucrative export, and the NNPC has not been able to account for billions of dollars in revenue. That's why President Muhammadu Buhari has not appointed anyone as the oil minister. He handles that highly sought-after portfolio himself in his second term as president, just as he did in his first. Corruption is also why some Nigerians aren't applauding China for pouring money into Nigeria's murky oil industry. A host on Nigeria's popular Wazobia TV network, Uvbi Ehigiamosue, put it this way.
They're not going to actually monitor your spending, you understand, but they will just give you the money. If this is how it is, we know how all those things have been now.
She says the Chinese oil company will not monitor how Nigeria will use $16 billion in investments. And we know how it goes in Nigeria, she says. Some say it's high time Nigeria moves away from its dependence on oil. Revenue from the oil industry accounts for almost 75% of the federal budget, according to the Nigerian Financial Watchdog Group budget. Dr. Nwoke Okala, an energy specialist at the Center for Research and Development at the University of Nigeria in Nsukka, says Nigeria should follow the global trend of exploring renewable energy sources as oil becomes less attractive. But for now, Nigeria will continue to set its ambitions on oil. Nigerian business mogul and the richest man in Africa, Aliko Dangote, is building what will be Africa's largest oil refinery in the Nigerian commercial city of Lagos. With an expected annual refining capacity of 10.4 million tons of gasoline, the new refinery will double Nigeria's refining capacity and help in meeting the increasing domestic demand for fuel. The $9 billion mega complex is expected to be complete at the end of 2020 and could take Nigeria from a fuel importer to a fuel exporter. Chika Odua for VOA News in Enugu.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. A World Wildlife Conference has adopted dozens of resolutions aimed at protecting animal and plant species threatened with extinction. CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, also tackled illegal international trade that threatens their survival. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the CITES conference in Geneva.
The United Nations reports about 1 million animal and plant species worldwide are threatened with extinction. The conference has responded to the rapid decline of iconic animals such as the giraffe, several species of sharks, and precious timber. It has revised the trade rules for dozens of wildlife species whose sustainability is threatened by over-harvesting, overfishing, or over-hunting. The conference also has expanded the capacity to fight illegal trade. CITES Secretary General Yvonne Higuero says illegal traders remain a force to be reckoned with. She praises the actions taken by representatives at the conference to combat the growing menace posed by the rapid pace with which wildlife crime is moving online.
For example, you adopted decisions on strengthening enforcement efforts for tortoises and freshwater turtles. You will also support efforts to tackle illegal trade in the sub-regions of West and Central Africa. This illegal trade affects elephant ivory and species such as pangolins, parrots, and rosewood. Another important decision was to establish the CITES Big Cat Task Force.
The task force, she explains, has a mandate to improve enforcement, tackle illegal trade, and promote collaboration on conserving tigers, lions, cheetahs, jaguars, and leopards. The illegal trade in wildlife is estimated to be worth up to $20 billion a year. Higuero says more needs to be done to assist countries to strengthen their criminal justice systems. She says more vigorous action will have to be taken to combat wildlife crime linked to the internet, which in today's digital world seems likely to increase.
I am pleased to note that CITES has now started to open a new digital front, both to more effectively regulate legal trade and to combat illegal trade. This will lead to more efficient border controls using modern, technology-based approaches, such as electronic risk management and targeted inspections.
CITES has some success stories under its belt. It notes vicuna populations in Bolivia, Peru, and parts of Argentina have been revived through sustainable use. Because of this, the conference has downlisted a regional vicuna population in Argentina, this from Appendix 1, which bans all commercial trade in at-risk species, to Appendix 2, which permits sustainable trade. The recovery of the American crocodile population of Mexico, which is seen as another conservation success, has been similarly downlisted to Appendix 2. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg arrived in New York City following a transatlantic trip on a sailboat. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
The 16-year-old will be attending a global warming conference at the United Nations. She led weekly protests in Sweden.
We need to stop destroying nature, and we need, and our war against nature must end.
She refused to fly because of the carbon cost of plane travel. Thunberg calls global warming a global crisis.
The biggest crisis humanity has ever faced, and if we don't manage to work together, to cooperate, and to work together despite our differences, then we will fail.
Thunberg's message to President Trump about global warming.
Listen to the science, and he obviously doesn't do that.
She plans to focus on spreading awareness. I'm Ed Donahue.
Taylor Swift is having a very good year. Her latest album, Lover, just released last Friday, in its second day, earned the most ever for an album in the U.S. That is, since her last album, Reputation, which sold more than a million copies in its first week in 2017. Swift also just won Video of the Year Sunday at the MTV Video Music Awards for her song You Need to Calm Down. Lover is expected to be number one on the Billboard 200 chart when it comes out on September 7th. This would be her sixth number one album. 20 years. Can I go where you go? Can we always? You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Lover. We could let our friends crash in the living room. This is our place. We made the call. And I'm highly suspicious that everyone who sees you wants you. I've loved you three summers now, honey, but I want them all.
This is the